It is Friday. Welcome to the program. My name is Mike Malloy, and my job is to piss you off so badly that you will get out and vote Republican or something. I don't know. I don't know what the function of this program is anymore. 7 past the hour. Thanks for tuning in. It is Friday. We're going to get to the WikiLeaks document dump in a moment, but a couple other things here. David Nywaard, again, writing at CNL, he's got a picture up at Crooks and Liars. And it's a front yard of a house, crappy-ass-looking little house. And there's a tree out front. Hanging from the tree is effigy of a black man, and standing in front of the hanging effigy is a phony Klans person in a robe. And this sick bastard calls this a Halloween display. Oh, my God. And as David points out, one of white racists' favorite lines, especially when they whine about the supposed racism of ethnic groups like the NAACP or La Raza or ACORN, they're really only about the same thing, pride in their racial heritage, right? Which, of course, they primarily display by demonizing, dehumanizing, terrorizing, belittling, and degrading people of other races. So here's a picture of this sick bastard down in Missouri. And the newspaper there, the television station, had this up on their website. At the request of Sheriff Rick Walter, Scott County homeowner Rick Hoskins removed a Halloween display in front of his home Wednesday. That's the subject of much controversy in the Sykeston area. The display, which featured a Ku Klux Klan figure alongside an effigy of a black man hanging from a noose, could be seen by drivers on Interstate 55. Jesus God. Sheriff Walter said his office had received several complaints about the display, so he contacted the office of prosecuting attorney Paul Boyd to see if it was within the sheriff department rights to remove it due to the problems it could cause. Prosecuting attorney Boyd encouraged the sheriff to discuss the matter with Mr. Hoskins and to ask Hoskins to take it down. Hoskins complied, but indicated he would contact his attorney with the intent of putting the decorations back up. Hoskins said, quote, "There's been a bunch of people that stopped by since I put them up, said they want to shake my hand. They said they're glad to see a little white pride is still left in this country." Hoskins also flies a Confederate flag in his front yard, says he has for years. Hoskins added, "They are my Halloween decorations. I think they speak for themselves." The most striking aspect of this, of course, is just how bold these asses are becoming. It used to be they hid their Klan robes in the closet. Now they're coming out. I wonder how this could be happening. What do you want to bet? We have no way to prove this. Let's make an imaginary bet. What do you want to bet this stupid bastard listens to Glenn Beck? Of course he does. Of course he does. Oh, man. We told you the other night about the freak that drove by an event where Senator Patty Murray was having a debate, I guess. And he was screaming obscenities, and he showed up. What did he have, a machete or a knife or a real sick, another Beck listener. So he got some prison time today, according to Seattle PI. This freak Charles Allen Wilson, 64, he said he was afraid. He was afraid. He was scared the health insurance reform would cut into his benefits. So he threatened repeatedly and in explicit language to kill Senator Patty Murray, channeling Glenn Beck again. Those threats made him a terrorist, according to U.S. District Court Judge John Konauer, and was deserving of a prison cell. So Konauer's order will send him to one. He was sentenced to 1 year in prison. That's not enough, Judge. Mr. Wilson of Selah, Washington, previously admitted to threatening Patty Murray. According to charging documents, Mr. Wilson expressed disdain for the health care reforms in a series of profanity-laced messages that he left on her phone. I want to effing kill you! Court documents say, Mr. Wilson said in one of his foul-mouthed calls to Murray's office, kill the effing senator! Hang the effing senator! I hope somebody puts an effing bullet between your effing eyes! He said in another call. Now, in contrast with the messages he left on Senator Murray's office, this little worm was very polite and contrite as he faced the judge today. He said, I was scared. I was scared. I regret these actions. I was totally wrong. And it is with humility that I ask your forgiveness. Whiny little... see, all these teabaggers, all the Beck listeners, all the right-wingers, all the militia types, they're all the same. They're all like this. Speaking to the judge, the little weasel's attorney noted that her client was concerned that federal insurance reform would cut into the government benefits he was receiving. Wilson was charged April 6th with threatening a federal official. He pleaded guilty to that charge June 10th. Wilson was undone in part by an FBI agent who posed as being with a group that wanted to repeal health care reform. Addressing the court, Assistant U.S. Attorney Todd Greenberg noted that Wilson was one of at least three people accused of threatening Democrats serving in Congress. And so on. And so on. Well, guess what? Guess what, you little snot-nosed teabag Beck fan? You won't have to worry about your health coverage for the next year. And maybe you'll have a cellmate who will look at you and say, you know what? I've been in this cell for a long time, and here you are. You're kind of cute. You know that. Come over here, and I want you to meet Mr. Eddie. I think you and Mr. Eddie are going to get along just fine.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to threaten Senator Murray and use the F word and say I was going to kill her. It just seemed like so much fun, and Glenn Beck told me to do it. He said to listen between the sentences. Please, Your Honor, don't send me to prison. I might have to have a chat with Mr. Eddie. Ah!
Oh, my God. Don't you just love these teabag bastards, huh? Aren't they just comedy? But these are the people that are going to be running the country after November 2nd. Honest to God, they really are. That's what the political pundits are telling us. And they know. Chuck Todd of NBC, he knows. He knows. All of the pundits know. After November 2nd coming, what is that, 12 days? The teabaggers are going to be running the U.S. Congress. Did you hear the, this is in Raw Story Today, Meg Whitman? Several years after California Republican gubernatorial candidate Meg Whitman donated $30 million to Princeton University, that school decided not to punish her son for an alleged rape. That's according to a new report by Gawker online. Gawker's Maureen O'Connor reports that in the spring of 2006, a classmate accused Griffith Rutherford Harsh V, Miss Whitman's son, of rape. By his own admission, Griffin Rutherford Harsh V met up with the girl after a night of partying and had sex with her. Gawker's Maureen O'Connor has more to say. Let me share it with you when we come back. Not that the parents should be charged with the crimes of the sons and daughters, but there's something that Meg Whitman did that just borders on hypocritical.
He's the primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
So, 21 past the hour, Meg Whitman's son was charged with rape at Princeton University. I love his name, Griffith Rutherford Harsh V. Ow! Harsh met up with this young woman after a night of partying and had sex with her, by his own admission. And Gawker's Maureen O'Connor writes, quote, "She woke the next morning with a black eye, bruised face, and she told friends, with no memories of the previous night," end quote, O'Connor. An anonymous friend of hers told the website that the girl didn't remember consenting or having sex. She was terrified, the friend said. She didn't want to press charges because it's Meg Whitman's son. She didn't want to go through that. She didn't go to the police. She didn't get a rape kit. Harsh was never arrested in relation to the incident, Meg Whitman's son, but after that summer, he was called to testify before Princeton University's Committee on Discipline. A source provided Gawker with Harsh's closing statement, quote, "I am deeply saddened and upset that," redacted, "finds herself in this situation where she cannot remember what occurred between us that night," end quote. He thought she had been sober enough to consent and suggested she injured herself in a fall. Her friend observed, quote, "How somebody could think it was okay to sleep with this girl who's bleeding from her face is beyond me," end quote. The panel decided there was not enough evidence to discipline Harsh. She went back to school and graduated in 2009. Harsh, the Meg Whitman campaign, Princeton University, and the alleged victim all declined to comment on the report. This wasn't the first time Master Harsh found himself in trouble during his Princeton years. In 2005, he was arrested for buying alcohol with a fake ID. Week after Princeton declined to discipline him on the rape accusations, Harsh was arrested for breaking another woman's ankle, but the charges were later dismissed. Gawker reports that Master Harsh has been absent from Meg Whitman's campaign. Gawker noted, quote, "The decision by Princeton officials to permit the son of one of its most prominent donors to remain in school following such serious allegations may raise questions about her influence at Princeton University, too." Now, the thing about this that makes my skin crawl reading it's typical expectation of the filthy wealthy, someone like Meg Whitman, who has spent, what, $140 million on her on her egomaniacal bid to be governor of California. What gets me about this is we're supposed to believe it is sheer coincidence that Meg Whitman donates $30 million to Princeton and the school decides not to punish her son for an alleged rape. My, my, my. Money talks. Ginny Thomas, who really, alcoholics do this. Let's face it. And I'm not busted up on alcoholics. Alcoholics have a disease. There are ways to maintain their disease in the same manner that there's ways to maintain diabetes or heart disease. There are ways to maintain and live a very successful life while one is an alcoholic. Ginny Thomas apparently has not discovered that yet. And Ginny Thomas makes phone calls at 7:30 in the morning to a woman who testified under oath before a Senate committee about sexual harassment by now Ginny Thomas's beloved husband, a U.S. Supreme Court justice, Uncle Clarence. So I'm not getting down on alcoholics. I understand that problem. I do. I said the other night, I spent an entire summer attending Al-Anon meetings because the woman I was involved with was, well, she had multiple addictions, but alcohol was the real booger bear. So Ginny gets my sympathy up to a point, and the point being where she allows her alcoholism to lead her into calling up someone who 19 years ago testified under oath and more or less threatening the woman, as if to say, look, bitch, I am the wife of Supreme Court Justice. It's about time you apologize to me. Well, I'm sure at this point, Ginny wishes she kept her damn mouth shut and the top on the bottle. There's something about a gin bottle. Once you open the damn thing, and it says, drink me, oh, please, drink me. It's pretty hard to resist that. But guess what? Another voice from the past now has arisen from the ether. Lillian McEwen. I'll tell you who she is in a minute.
Watts of free speech. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. All right. Who is Lillian McEwen? Well, according to the Washington Post today, for nearly 20 years, Lillian McEwen has been silent, part of history. Yet she's been absent from it. When Anita Hill accused Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment during his Supreme Court confirmation hearings in 1991. Uncle Clarence vehemently denied the allegations, and his handlers cited his steady relationship with another woman in an effort to deflect Anita Hill's allegations. That woman? Lillian McEwen. At the time, she was on good terms with Uncle Clarence. She's a former assistant U.S. attorney and Senate Judiciary Committee counsel. She had dated him for years, even attending a March 1985 White House state dinner as his guest or date. She had worked on Capitol Hill and was wary of entering the political cauldron of the hearing. She was never asked to testify. Now she says that Thomas often did inappropriate things about women he met at work, and that he could have added, she could have added her voice to the others, but she didn't. She didn't pile on. Right now, Lillian McEwen is 65. She's retired from a successful career as a prosecutor, law professor, and administrative law judge for federal agencies. She has been twice married, twice divorced, has a 32-year-old daughter. She lives in a comfortable townhouse in Southwest Washington, and she is silent no more. She said, quote, I have nothing to be afraid of now. She told the Washington Post, he, Uncle Clarence, he was always actively watching the women he worked with to see if they could be potential partners. It was a hobby of his, end quote. In her Senate testimony, Anita Hill, who worked with Uncle Clarence, the two federal agencies, said that Thomas would make sexual comments to her at work, including references to scenes in hardcore pornographic films. Thomas, Uncle Clarence, said to the committee, quote, if I use that kind of grotesque language with one person, it would seem to me that there would be traces of it throughout the employees who work closely with me, or the other individuals who heard bits and pieces of it, or various levels of it, end quote. Miss McEwen, Lillian McEwen, scoffs softly when asked about Thomas's indignation, which has barely cooled in the 19 years since the hearings. In his vivid 2007 memoir, Uncle Clarence calls Anita Hill a tool of liberal activists outraged because he did not fit their idea of what an African American should be. However, Lillian McEwen said Hill's long ago description of Uncle Clarence's nasty ass behavior resonated with her. She told the Washington Post, quote, he was obsessed with porn. He would talk about what he had seen in magazines and films as if there was something worth noting, end quote. According to Lillian McEwen, Uncle Clarence also would tell her about women he encountered at work. He was partial to women with large breasts, she said. In an instance at work, Uncle Clarence was so impressed that he asked one woman her bra size. According to Lillian McEwen. Presented with some of Miss McEwen's assertions by the Washington Post, Supreme Court spokeswoman Kathy Arberg said Uncle Clarence was unavailable for comment. However bizarre they may seem, Lillian McEwen's recollections resemble accounts shared by other women that swirled around the Thomas confirmation. Angela Wright, who in 1984 worked as public affairs director at the EEOC, said during Thomas's long tenure as chairman that she knew of similar accounts, and she shared them with Senate investigators. Once when walking into an EEOC seminar with Uncle Clarence, he asked her, what size are your breasts? I mean, it just goes on and on. Now, is this in the National Enquirer? No, it's in the Washington Post. Another woman, Sukari Hardened, who worked as a special assistant to Thomas in 1985 and 86, wrote in a letter to the Judiciary Committee at the time that, quote, if you were young, black, female, and reasonably attractive, you knew full well you were being inspected and auditioned as a female by Uncle Clarence. Still, Miss McEwen, Lillian McEwen, a Democrat, acknowledged growing increasingly irritated with Uncle Clarence's conservative jurisprudence and his penchant for casting himself as a victim in the Anita Hill controversy. McEwen met Thomas in 1979 when both were among a tiny handful of young black Capitol Hill staffers. A group of them would hold monthly meetings at neighborhood watering holes, and soon enough, McEwen and Uncle Clarence had struck up a close relationship. At the time, according to the Washington Post, Uncle Clarence was married to his first wife and working for then-Senator John Danforth, Republican of Missouri. Miss McEwen, meanwhile, had recently separated from her first husband. Over time, she said, Uncle Clarence would come by her place for drinks. She said the relationship grew intimate after Thomas left his wife in 1981. She said they broke off their relationship in about 1986. Throughout the years, McEwen said she's remained reasonably friendly with Uncle Clarence. On one or two occasions, she said, she brought friends to his Supreme Court chambers where they sat for long conversations. But now she tells the Washington Post, quote, I know Clarence would not be happy with me. Miss McEwen said, quote, I have no hostility toward him. It's just that he has manufactured a different reality over time. That's the problem that he has, end quote. Oh, Jenny, what have you done? Bad Jenny, bad. Sit. Go get another chip. Bad Jenny, bad. And Uncle Clarence, I mean, oh, my God, this is a sitting Supreme. He never should have been confirmed. You know it as well as I do. But this is back in the day. As a matter of fact, he was confirmed by the slimmest majority in the history of Supreme Court confirmations. What, 4 votes, I think? And George Herbert Walker Bush is kind of a kick in the face to black folk in this country who had endured the struggle that they had endured over the generations, over the centuries. George Herbert Walker Bush, this warmongering little rat bastard, saw his chance to strike back after the retirement, or was it the death, I forget, of Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall, a giant in several areas, not just civil rights, in jurisprudence. A classic litigator. And by all accounts, a great Supreme Court justice. Well, that just stuck in George Herbert Walker Bush's craw. All he could produce, his sons, were a bunch of goddamn fraud committer, thieves, liars, sneaks, drug addicts, drunks. Even unto the second generation. That's all Herbert Walker Bush could do. Well, I don't know about this Negro, Thurgood Marshall. I know what I'll do. So he nominates Uncle Clarence. And the rest, as they say, is history. Back when WikiLeaks first released their documents about the Afghan war, top military officials wigged out. And not just military officials. Do you remember the story? Do you remember the reaction of the media and anyone who could get near a microphone that the revelations inside those WikiLeaks documents, or not WikiLeaks, but Defense Department documents that were released to, who was it, a newspaper in the UK, New York Times, and I think Der Spiegel. I think those are the three. It really doesn't matter. But they were released to the newspapers, then released on the website. CNN reported this July 29th, this past July. Quote, top military official, WikiLeaks founder may have blood on his hands. And CNN went on to say, the top U.S. military official said Thursday that Julian Assange, founder of WikiLeaks, was risking lives to make a political point by publishing thousands of military reports from Afghanistan. Admiral Mike Mullen, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, at a news conference at the Pentagon, quote, Mr. Assange can say whatever he likes about the greater good he thinks he and his sources are doing, but the truth is they might already have on their hands the blood of some young soldier or that of an Afghan family, end quote, end quote, end quote. In equally stern comments in the same session, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said the massive leak will have significant impact on troops and allies, giving away techniques and procedures. Gates said, quote, the battlefield consequences of the release of these documents are potentially severe and dangerous for our troops, our allies, and Afghan partners, and may well damage our relationships and reputations in that key part of the world. Gates went on to say, intelligence sources and methods, as well as military tactics, techniques, and procedures will become known to our adversaries, end quote. Stick around. I got a punchline for you. Stick around.
your news unfiltered, only with Mike Malone.
Ten before the hour. Podcast trivia next hour, so stick around, okay? Anyway, CNN quoted all sorts of people who said the WikiLeaks release of Afghanistan information from the Pentagon would result in all sorts of problems. CNN, The Guardian, July 26, 2010, quote, the White House today condemned whistleblower WikiLeaks, accusing the website of putting the lives of U.S., U.K., and coalition troops in danger and threatening America's national security, blah, blah, blah. Senator Carl Levin, CNN, August 1st, 2010. Candy Crowley, I want to turn you to WikiLeaks, which also comes under your bailiwick to a certain extent. Some 90,000 documents with secret information or top secret information. Can you quantify the damage? Senator Levin, not yet. I think that's being assessed right now as to how many sources of information that gave us information that was useful to us are now in jeopardy. That determination, a damage assessment is being made right now by the Pentagon, but there was quite clearly damage. Department of Defense spokesman Jeff Morrell, August 5th, 2010, quote, WikiLeaks' public disclosure last week of a large number of our documents has already threatened the safety of our troops, our allies, and Afghan citizens who are working with us to help bring about peace and peace and stability in that part of the world. The Heritage Foundation's Con Carroll, August 24, 2010, quote, Julian Assange, you know, molesting charges aside, is a criminal. He broke the law. He is, you know, a murderer of American and Afghan people. His carelessness has killed people. Stephen Aftergood, self-proclaimed transparency advocate and leading WikiLeaks critic, August 16, 2010. WikiLeaks has failed to demonstrate similar discernment in handling classified records, and it will be up to others to try to repair the damage it has caused. Liz Cheney. Quote, our government should make sure that Mr. Assange, WikiLeaks founder and spokesman, never gets a U.S. visa. He has blood on his hands. She didn't stop there. She went on to say, what he's done is very clearly aiding and abetting Al-Qaeda. And as I said, he may very well be responsible for the deaths of American soldiers in Afghanistan. Newt Gingrich, Newsmax interview, July 31st, 2010. Question, what does that do to the Afghanistan war effort, and how does that put our men and women at risk? Gingrich, the release of these documents should be regarded as an act of treason. When you release 70,000, 80,000 documents, you don't know how many people you're going to kill. Frankly, I think we should be very aggressive about the website that was set up, WikiLeaks, and I think we should be very, very strong on the condemnation of the newspapers that published them. It goes on and on and on. And then there was this past Sunday from CNN Today, quote, the online leak of thousands of secret military documents from the war in Afghanistan by the website WikiLeaks did not disclose any sensitive intelligence sources or methods, the Department of Defense concluded. Senator, the assessment revealed in a letter from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates to the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator Carl Levin, comes after a thorough Pentagon review of the more than 70,000 documents posted to the controversial whistleblower site in July. The defense secretary said that the published documents do contain names of some cooperating Afghans who could face reprisal by Taliban. But a senior NATO official in Kabul told CNN there has not been a single case of Afghans needing protection or to be moved because of the leak. Let's repeat that. Despite Secretary Gates' ongoing assertion that, quote, the initial assessment in no way discounts the risk of to national security, end quote, and that, quote, there's still concern Afghans named in the published documents could be retaliated against by the Taliban, quote, end quote. Even the Department of Defense and NATO admit that the WikiLeaks release, quote, did not disclose any sensitive intelligence sources or methods, and that there has not been a single case of Afghans needing protection or to be moved because of the leak. Nonetheless, the accusation that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange have, quote, blood on their hands, was, as intended, trumpeted around the world for weeks without much question or challenge. It's been clear from the start that despite the valid concern that WikiLeaks should have been more vigilant in redacting the names of Afghan civilians, the Pentagon and its media servants were drastically exaggerating the harm. As the Associated Press noted on August 17th, quote, "The WikiLeaks leak is unrivaled in its scope, but so far there is no evidence that any Afghan named in the leaked document as defectors or informants from the Taliban insurgency have been harmed in retaliation." The AP went on, quote, "Some private analysts, in fact, think the danger has been overstated." John Prados, a military and intelligence historian who works for the Anti-Secrecy National Security Archive, said, quote, "I am underwhelmed by the argument. The Pentagon is hyping," end quote. And on August 11, even the Department of Defense was forced to admit to the Washington Post the complete absence of any evidence to support its wild accusations. Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell said, quote, "We have yet to see any harm come to anyone in Afghanistan that we can directly tie to exposure in the WikiLeaks documents." He went on to say, nonetheless, the initial spate of hysterically, or no, that was the end of his quote. "Nonetheless, the initial spate of hysterically accusatory rhetoric and the fact that those accusations have been subsequently revealed as baseless will receive little attention and undo none of that deceit-based damage." We'll be back with the latest WikiLeaks report after the break. Stay with us. Seven past the hour. Coming up next hour, we have some more information about Joe Miller and his gang of brown shirts up in Alaska. Also some stuff from Michael Moore. Right now we are, and by the way, you conservatives who love to listen to this program while you sit naked in the darkness, you better go away because you can't handle the truth. You can't handle anything other than Barack Obama's Kenyan. So get off my radio program, okay? Coming up in about half an hour, podcast trivia. All right. The CNN has kind of an overview. Julian Assange says the Iraq documents, about 500,000 military documents from the Iraq War, contain evidence of U.S. war crimes. The documents detail the deaths of over 100,000 people. These are civilians. The Pentagon says the documents present a distorted picture of events in Iraq. And the way CNN gets into this, WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Julian Assange told CNN in an exclusive interview today that the roughly 400,000 Iraq War military documents released by his organization show, quote, compelling evidence of war crimes, end quote, committed by the U.S.-led coalition and Iraqi government forces. They detail the deaths of more than 100,000 people. Assange said he expects 40 wrongful death lawsuits will be filed as a result of the leaked documents. The Pentagon immediately condemned the document release, claiming it presents a distorted picture of developments in Iraq over the past several years. Well, what are they going to say, right? The so-called significant activities reports published by WikiLeaks are, according to the Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell, quote, initial raw observations by tactical units, end quote. Morrell went on to say, quote, they are essentially snapshots of events, both tragic and mundane, and do not tell the whole story. That said, Morrell went on, the period covered by these reports has been well chronicled in news stories, books, and films, and the release of these field reports does not bring new understanding to Iraq's past, end quote. Morrell did say, however, that the release, quote, does expose secret information that could make our troops even more vulnerable to attack in the future, end quote. Now, where have we heard this? Oh, that's right. From the Afghanistan document release, right? Jeff Morrell went on to say, the Pentagon spokesman, quote, this security breach could very well get our troops and those they are fighting with killed, end quote. Really? Well, didn't you say that last time? Mr. Morrell, there's an old fable. Is it, I'm not sure who wrote the fable. It's the story of the boy who cried wolf. The story of the boy who cried wolf. Mr. Jeff Morrell, might be something you want to read tonight, if you can work it into reading these wiki labels. Was it Aesop, one of Aesop's fables? I don't know. Assange dismissed concerns that the publication of the documents could endanger U.S. troops and Iraqi civilians, asserting that the Pentagon, quote, cannot find a single person that has been harmed, end quote, due to WikiLeaks' previous release of documents related to the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan. The Defense Department has assembled a group of 120 experts ready to review the Iraq documents, according to Pentagon spokesman Colonel Dave Lappin. The Pentagon, as it did after the Afghan documents were released, had demanded that WikiLeaks not publish the documents on the Internet and return whatever copies it has. We mean it! Assange told CNN that the newly released documents, quote, reveal 6 years of the Iraq War at a ground level detail, end quote, including events that occurred after Barack Obama took office in 2009. Among other things, the documents show evidence of 204 incidents that were clearly torture against detainees by coalition soldiers. There are also reports, Mr. Assange said, of, quote, cases of people trying to surrender and being killed in the process, shot dead. Assange said he hoped the end of the U.S. combat mission in Iraq would not diminish the impact of the release of the documents. About 50,000 U.S. troops remain in the country. Assange said, quote, I'm hoping that people understand that the Iraq war goes on. There are deaths of significant numbers every week as a result primarily of the sectarian violence, but also because of policing being conducted by a fairly brutal regime, unaccountable and not properly checked, end quote. Let me digress. I thought that was our argument for overthrowing Saddam Hussein, that it was a brutal regime, unaccountable and not properly supervised, as it had been by several U.S. presidents prior to the time that we decided Saddam needed to go. This is really sick stuff. This is really bad. Got an email from Gorilla Monk. He said, all those innocent people murdered who are just trying to get through another long day, like you and me, killed by our bloodthirsty, murderous troops. For what crime? For what reason? I have to tell you, Mike, I'm a tough son of a bitch, but I have tears in my eyes as I read these new Iraq War logs. And the worst part is knowing that I and every other American have blood on our hands because we didn't stop everything and march on Washington every single day until this illegal occupation was stopped. Shame on us. From Gorilla Monk. Assange says That in contrast to WikiLeaks' decision to withhold 15,000 Afghan documents, this time the organization had taken what he called an opt-in approach and redacted everything except for things cleared by hand. He said, quote, previously, when we just withheld documents in their entirety, it wasn't clear to people all the work that we had done, end quote. Assange dismissed reports of internal disputes within WikiLeaks, chalking them up to a small handful of disgruntled employees who had been suspended. While acknowledging that he personally has become a source of controversy, Assange said he would not step aside. He said, quote, this organization does not let anyone hang out to dry. We always expect tremendous criticism. It is my role to be the lightning rod, to attract the attacks against the organization for our work, and that is a difficult role. On the other hand, he said, I get undue credit. End quote. Assange refused to address allegations of rape and molestation that he's now facing in Sweden. Allegations that, surprise, 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 came out after the Afghanistan documents were published. He said, quote, it's completely disgusting. He told Al Jazeera on August 22nd that the accusations against him are, quote, clearly a smear campaign. The only question, he said, is who's behind it. Oh, I could guess. I have a multiple choice answer for you, Julian, as to who's behind it. New York Times has published a synopsis of several categories that are contained within these documents, and then they have at their website, nytimes.com, click here to read the document. Click here to read the document. PDF downloads where you can read them yourself. The reports, the New York Times says, in the archive disclosed by WikiLeaks offer an incomplete yet startlingly graphic portrait of one of the most contentious issues in the Iraq War. How many Iraqi civilians have been killed and by whom? The documents also reveal many previously unreported instances in which American soldiers killed civilians at checkpoints, from helicopters, in operations. Such killings are a central reason Iraqis turned against the American presence in their country, a situation that is now being repeated in Afghanistan. The archive contains reports of at least four cases of lethal shootings from helicopters. In the bloodiest, on July 16, 2007, as many as 26 Iraqis were killed, half of them civilians. However, the tally was called in by two different people, and it is possible that the deaths were counted twice. We'll be right back.
The Mike Malloy Show. Talk radio matters here.
21 past the hour. All right, if you want to play podcast trivia, Kathy has opened up the lines. The phone number here is 877-996-2556. If you get the right answer to the podcast trivia question, you win a one-year subscription to Malloy Show podcast downloads commercial-free. 877-996-2556. Getting back to the WikiLeaks release about our adventure in Iraq, 500,000 documents. In another case, in February 2007, an Apache helicopter shot and killed two Iraqi men believed to have been firing mortars, even though they made surrendering motions. Because according to a military lawyer cited in the report, quote, they cannot surrender to aircraft and are still valid targets, end quote. The shooting, according According to the Times, those unusual, at least three other instances reported in the archive, Iraqis surrendered to helicopter crews without being shot. The Pentagon did not respond to questions from the New York Times about the rules of engagement for the helicopter strike. The pace of civilian deaths often served as a kind of pulse whose steady beat told of the success or failure of America's war effort. Americans on both sides of the war debate argued bitterly over facts that grew hazier as the war deepened. The archive does not put that argument to rest by giving a precise body count. As a 2008 report to Congress on the topic makes clear, the figures serve as guideposts, not hard totals. Now keep in mind here, we're talking about dead Iraqi civilians, dead as a result of our invasion and occupation. Guideposts. But it does seem to suggest numbers that are roughly in line with those compiled by several sources, including Iraq Body Count, an organization that tracks civilian deaths using press reports, a method the Bush administration repeatedly derided as unreliable and producing inflated numbers. Why, of course, the Bush crime family would say that. Why wouldn't they? In all, the five-year archive lists more than 100,000 dead from 2004 to 2009. A 2008 congressional report warned that record-keeping in the war had been so problematic that such statistics should be looked at only as guideposts. In a statement on Friday, Iraq Body Count, which did a preliminary analysis of the archive, estimated that it listed 15,000 deaths that had not been previously disclosed anywhere. Now, there were lots of pictures available if you had the stomach, literally, to look at them, of how many of those dead were children and the degree to which their bodies had been ripped to pieces by our armaments and our so-called coalition partners' armaments. Times goes on. The archives tell thousands of individual stories of loss whose consequences are still being felt in Iraqi families today. Misunderstandings at checkpoints were often lethal. At one Marine checkpoint, sunlight glinting off a windshield of a car that did not slow down led to the shooting death of a mother and the wounding of three of her daughters and her husband. Hand signals flashed to stop vehicles were often not understood, and soldiers and Marines who, without interpreters, were unable to speak to the survivors, were left to wonder why. According to one particularly painful entry from 2006, an Iraqi wearing a tracksuit was killed by an American sniper, who later discovered that the victim was the platoon's interpreter. And even when Americans were at the center of the action, as in the western city of Fallujah in 2004, none of the Iraqis they killed were categorized as civilians by the Pentagon. In the early years of the war, the Pentagon maintained that it did not track Iraqi civilian deaths. But it began releasing rough counts in 2005 after members of Congress demanded a more detailed accounting of the state of the war. This month, the Associated Press reported that the Pentagon in July had quietly posted its fullest tally of the death toll of Iraqi civilians and security forces ever, numbers that were first requested in 2005 through a Freedom of Information Act. It was not clear why the total, 76,939 Iraqi civilians killed between January 2004 and August 2008, were significantly less than the sum of the archive's death count. Point of fact, civilians have borne the brunt of modern warfare, with 10 civilians dying for every soldier in wars fought since the mid-20th century, compared with 9 soldiers killed for every civilian in World War I. That's according to a 2001 study by the International Committee of the Red Cross. Podcast trivia when we come back, and then a bit more from the WikiLeaks 400,000 document dump on our adventure in Iraq. It's been a long, long time coming. once again for podcast trivia here on the Molloy Program, where with a simple correct answer, using the favorite of college students around the world, the multiple choice system, you can win a one-year subscription to Molloy Program podcast downloads commercial-free. Be delivered to your email every day or something like that. Is that how they get them, Fabi? I'll be damned, really. All right, let's give it a shot here. Jerry is in Baltimore listening on XM. Hi, Jerry.
Hello.
Hey, can you hear me okay?
Just barely.
Okay, let me put you on hold for a second, Jerry. Steve is in Miami listening on Sirius. Hey, Steve.
Hey.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. You ready to give this a shot?
Let's go for it.
Okay, here we go. Teabagger Darling and Senator Wannabe from, we'll just leave the state. It's Delaware. Christine O'Donnell, in a recent debate, was surprised to learn that the guarantee of separation of church and state is found in A, the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, B, the 95 Theses, C, the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, or D, the Necronomicon.
I want to say D, but I think it's A.
A, the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution?
No, the First Amendment.
Okay.
The First Amendment, that was...
C, that all was, right, okay.
C.
That's it.
That's it.
All right, Steve, congratulations. If you'll hold on a second, Kathy will get the pertinent information, and you will get a one-year gift subscription to Molloy Show podcast downloads, commercial-free. And as always, thanks to the people who donate these. We are constantly, most of whom want to remain anonymous, some of whom don't specify one way or the other, but to the people who send in checks, sometimes to the amount of 10 free podcast subscriptions for our contest winners. Thank you very much. It's very much appreciated. It is about 24 before the hour. I don't know how much further I should go tonight with this. The WikiLeaks document dump, this one is enormous. You will be able, over the weekend, or perhaps after the weekend, to download PDF files of everything as the documents appear, rather than hear them filtered through me or anyone else in talk radio. I am convinced, as I'm sure you are too, that the right wing will have a field day with this, distorting, lying, misrepresenting, which is what they always do. This is what the right-wing media freaks do. Did you hear about this guy? He was on, or Keith Olbermann talked about him tonight, or was it Rachel? I think it was Keith Olbermann. He's a Tea Party-backed congressional candidate in Texas, and he's going Sharon Angle's suggestive talk of Second Amendment remedies one better. He says violent overthrow of the U.S. government is on the table. And this crazy son of a bitch claims to be a minister, right? Stephen Broden, who's running against Democratic Representative Eddie Johnson in Texas' 30th Congressional District, said in a recent interview with Dallas's WFAA television, quote, "Our nation was founded on violence. The option was on the table. I don't think that we should ever remove anything from the table as it relates to our liberties and our freedoms." Unbelievable. He's a good friend of Glenn Beck. He's on Glenn Beck's program all the time. The WFAA's segment on Broden highlights statements that he made at a 9/12 rally several months ago, and he's now walking away from. Broden said at that back in June, quote, this administration is trying to figure out how to deal with that stress, and so they are doing end-of-life counseling in order to depopulate that particular group of people. I don't know what the hell he's talking about. I don't know. He says, I don't think that they're trying to get senior citizens to die prematurely. I think they are entertaining end-of-life counseling based on economic viability. What? Oh, you crazy bastard. This is what happens to people when Glenn Beck gets inside your head. You become insane. Or Michelle Bachmann. Michelle Bachmann is clinically mad. You can tell. All you have to do is listen to her. All you have to do with Glenn Beck is listen to him, if you dare. If you are already addled to the point, politically I'm speaking, where you can't tell your ass from last Saturday, then Glenn Beck will have great fun removing your thought processes and replacing them with his sick, creepy worldview, sort of like Jim Jones did with the group down in Guyana. But it's just astonishing to me that somebody can get out there and, in a sense, advocate the violent overthrow of the U.S. government and not have federal officials swooping down on him. I mean, free speech is one thing, but this is one of the prohibitions. Just like you cannot falsely shout fire in a crowded theater. I always hear people say, well, you can't shout fire in a crowded theater. Well, the hell you can't. If the theater's on fire, yeah, you better shout it. No. You can't falsely shout it just for sport to see people trample one another and die. Well, you also can't advocate the violent overthrow of the U.S. government. It's just not allowed. This freak, Broden, also compared the current state of affairs in America to those in Nazi Germany during the Holocaust? God damn. Broden said at this rally that WFAA reported on, quote, let me tell you that is something that happened in Germany when the Jews were walking into the furnaces and they didn't even try to stop or fight their way. They walked in because they did not believe that this was happening. They didn't believe that humanity could be so evil. I am submitting to you tonight, that is where America is right now. They are our enemies, and we must resist them. End quote. When asked by WFA if he thought Obama was like Hitler, Broden decided differently. Whether or not Broden thinks there is a connection between the President of the United States and the fascist dictator of Germany, however, he does appear to believe that there is a conspiracy of, quote, Darwinian eugenics, end quote, against the black community, currently manifesting itself in American society. Well, if that's true, Mr. Broden, the people with whom you hang out are the ones designing it and executing it, you stupid bastard. Where do these people come from? Where do these people come? Oh, that's right. He's one of Glenn Beck's house guests. Let's put it that way. So the violent overthrow of the United States government is now part of political rhetoric. Well, it's free speech, right? Man. Going back to the story about Meg Whitman's kid, who had charged with assaulting women and or assaulting woman, singular, rape charges. The charges were dropped. And according to Raw Story, one could, if one was just an evil, liberal, communist bastard, one could come to the conclusion that the $30 million that Meg Whitman donated to Princeton University prior to her son's assault charge, that might have had something to do with the fact that Princeton decided not to pursue this. Well, I got an email shortly after telling you that story tonight from Mary in Denver. Hello again, Mike. My youngest kid graduated from Princeton in 2002. I attended almost all the Joyce events, including the baccalaureate speech given by one Meg Whitman. then CEO of eBay. Princeton does not invite outside speakers to orate at the actual graduation ceremony, that honor being historically and perpetually reserved to the president of the college. It does, however, invite illustrious public figures to give a baccalaureate address. The list of those guests can seem a little house of horrors to those of us of the liberal persuasion, for example, General David Petraeus in 2009. Even at that time, in spite of being the early adapting internet geek and eBay aficionado, 2002, I thought there was something distinctly unpleasant about the woman. I'm also a feminist, so my reaction was doubly perturbing. She was simply awful, so full of herself and her memories of being such a cool Princeton undergrad back in the day. Of course, then it was announced that she had given a gazillion dollars to Princeton so that a new dorm could be built with her name on it. I'm so proud of my two Princeton grads and their accomplishments, but the institution can be a real cesspool of money and misbehavior, like most of our so-called elite colleges. As ever, Mary in Denver.
Heavy duty, zircon encrusted tweezers in my hand, every up.
Ten before the hour. George in Oregon writes, sent in a comment that was on commondreams.org following the WikiLeaks release. And the writer put it this way: as a German, I can say only one thing. It's progressive. Stop it while you can. He's talking about the move to fascism. If you think you have reached the bottom, better rethink. It can go worse. What's happening to the U.S. helped me to understand my own history and why things spun so out of control. It's self-interest masqueraded in wrath, greed, sloth, pride, lust, envy, and gluttony. It's the driving engine of corruption. As long as people don't care and act out of self-interest, things will become worse. Looking in the other direction just to protect your status quo would do no good. Now, The Guardian in the U.K., is a little bit more unmitigated in its reporting from the way the New York Times mitigated, would that be? Yeah, is reporting it. This is what the Guardian says. A grim picture of the U.S. and Britain's legacy in Iraq has been revealed in a massive leak of American military documents that detail torture, summary executions, and war crimes. Blah, 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 blah. The new logs detail how U.S. authorities failed to investigate hundreds of reports of abuse, torture, rape, and even murder by Iraqi police and soldiers whose conduct appears to be systematic and normally unpunished. A helicopter gunship involved in a notorious Baghdad incident had previously killed Iraqi insurgents after they tried to surrender. More than 15,000 civilians died in previously unknown incidents. U.S. and U.K. officials have insisted that no official record of civilian casualties exists. But the logs record 66,081 non-combatant deaths out of a total of 109,000 fatalities. The numerous reports of detainee abuse, often supported by medical evidence, describe prisoners shackled, blindfolded, hung by the wrists or ankles, subjected to whipping, punching, kicking, or electric shocks. Six reports end with the detainee's apparent death. As recently as December last year, the Americans were passed a video apparently showing Iraqi army officers executing a prisoner in Tal Afar, northern Iraq. The log states, quote, the footage shows approximately 12 Iraqi army soldiers, 10 IA soldiers were talking to one another while two soldiers held the detainee. The detainee had his hands bound. The footage shows the IA soldiers moving the detainee into the street, pushing him to the ground, punching him, and then shooting him. A Pentagon spokesman told the New York Times that under its procedure, when reports of Iraqi abuse were received, the U.S. military, quote, notifies the responsible government of Iraq agency or ministry for investigation and follow-up. End quote. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It just goes on and on. Now, it's very risky to read this stuff. I wish Tony Blair or George Bush would weigh in on this, right? And Dick Cheney, this blood-drenched son of a bitch who's still wandering the countryside in the United States. A guy who, let's not forget, so much of this stuff is easy to forget. Had there not been Nuremberg war trials, criminal trials, for the Nazi high command, civilian as well as the military, the world would not have known of the abuses committed by that fascist regime. Equally so, the trials of the Japanese high command. Not to equate our wars of opportunity, we are only responsible for accounting our own dead, depending on who you want to believe, 120,000 up to 1 million people, chump change, compared to what other fascist regimes have committed in terms of mass killing. But how are we to have a record if it's not for WikiLeaks? How is that to happen? Huh? Of course, the attack on the character of Julian Assange was absolutely necessary. And what better way than to attempt to label him a child molester? I mean, rapist is not sufficient. Killer doesn't work. Arsonist is penny ante. So in order to try to devalue Pentagon reports, attack the person who runs the organization that accepts these documents and then releases them. Doesn't that make sense? Of course it does. And how do you attack him? As the people engineering this attack on Assange are well aware, nobody anywhere, except in certain countries, appreciates child molesters. Now, in Afghanistan, what we would consider to be child molestation is considered part of their cultural heritage. You didn't know that? I was going to do that story one night, and I just thought, oh, the hell with this. But the point being that Assange is vulnerable, as is anyone, to a charge of child molestation. So nail him with that. In the meantime, the documents speak for themselves. Doesn't make any difference what happens to Julian Assange. The documents, the Department of Defense documents, speak for themselves. I'm going to spend some time this weekend trying to figure some of this stuff out and cover it again next week. But coming up next hour, the United States has its first honest-to-God brown shirt fascist candidate for the United States Senate. And we've got the information to prove it to you. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. 7 past the hour. All right, as promised, I wanted to get to this Michael Moore from his blog, Michael Moore essay. First of all, let me see a show of hands. How many of you read Grapes of Wrath? 20, 30. Okay, enough of you read it. I read it, I think the first time I read it was in high school. That would be 100 years ago, before it was written. And then the next time, of course, the next two times I read it was just for the sake of reading. The first time was an assignment. That's the way most of us do that. Michael Moore writes, so how do the Wall Street boys feel after destroying the world economy while pocketing billions and then getting bailed out by everyone else in America? I'm sure they're filled with remorse and desperately trying to make it up to us, right? Quote from the New York Observer, quote, the first thing that needs to happen, I think, is to get these people out of their homes. A man wearing a bespoke blue striped shirt, a Hermes tie patterned with elephants and Ferragamo loafers said recently. Correct. I'll explain, the veteran member of a bank restructuring and advisory team said. The question to me is not, do you foreclose or do you not foreclose? The question is when and with what philosophy you foreclose, the man on the bank restructuring team said. If you want to reduce the amount of leveraged homeowners you have, you need to ultimately kick them out of their homes. A colleague walked up. His recommendation was to burn houses. It would lower the supply. End quote. From the New York Observer. Michael writes, that's from a new article about Wall Street in the New York Observer, the newspaper for Manhattan's richest people. It's the only paper I've ever seen that's printed on pink newsprint, except for the Financial Times, the paper for the world's richest people. And parenthetically, I don't know whether rich people are naturally attracted to pink paper or whether it's really expensive and only they can afford it. Whatever the reason, it's meant to say F you to everyone else. Anyway, here's what I'm wondering. Michael writes, millions of people are getting kicked out of their homes who need a place to live. Millions of homes are sitting empty and their value decaying along with their neighborhoods. And all this banker can say with a straight face, I presume, is to burn down the houses? Isn't that insane? It is. Because capitalism is insane. It doesn't matter that we have a giant oversupply of something and a giant number of people who desperately need that specific something. The only thing that matters is, can this something be sold at a profit? If not, the obvious solution is to reduce supply by setting it on fire. And maybe this will create a business opportunity for the Koch brothers to sell tissues to America's newly homeless as they watch the empty houses burn down. And here's the punchline, though I'm sure that Wall Street banker had no idea. There's nothing new about this. We've been here before. Here's a famous passage from The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck about the insanity of a system that required California farms to burn food during the Great Depression, even as people starved. Quote, behind the fruitfulness are men of understanding and knowledge and skill. Men who experiment with seed, endlessly developing the techniques for greater crops of plants. These are great men. They have transformed the world with their knowledge. The works of the roots of the vines, of the trees, must be destroyed to keep up the price. And this is the saddest, bitterest thing of all. Carloads of oranges dumped on the ground. The people came for miles to take the fruit, but this could not be. How would they buy oranges at 20 cents a dozen if they could drive out and pick them up? And men with hoses squirt kerosene on the oranges. And they are angry at the crime, angry at the people who have come to take the fruit. A million people hungry, needing the fruit, and kerosene sprayed over the Golden Mountains. There's a crime here that goes beyond denunciation. There is a sorrow here that weeping cannot symbolize. There is a failure here that topples all our success. The fertile earth, the straight tree rows, the sturdy trunks, and the ripe fruit. And children dying of pellagra must die because a profit cannot be made from an orange. And coroners must fill in the certificates. Died of malnutrition. Because the food must rot, must be forced to rot. In the souls of the people, the grapes of wrath are filling and growing heavy for the vintage. End quote. John Steinbeck. The Democrats, Michael Moore says, led by Franklin D. Roosevelt and pushed by unions, harvested the Depression's grapes of wrath and created with them the foundations of middle-class America. And someone's going to harvest 2010's grapes of wrath, but it doesn't have to be us. In fact, if you're like me, you're getting very worried about who it might be. Michael Moore writing at his blog site, Burning Down the House. I have a feeling that, this is my hope, that more and more people can understand that the natural progression of capitalism, and it has occurred in our lifetime, I think Hitler and Mussolini and Franco and anyone else who experimented with fascism over the years were way ahead of their time. They tried to force fascism at a time when capitalism wasn't ready to mutate into fascism. The natural progression of capitalism in theory, because capitalism has to have constantly expanding markets, but it also has to have constantly deteriorating labor costs or lessening of labor costs. Well, anyone with the sense of a sack of owl droppings would understand that at some point that can't continue. At some point, natural resources become, if not depleted, at least become or come to the point where the conflict caused by the pursuit of capitalism to gather them in, which is what China's doing with rare earths right now, conflicts with the desire of people to make a living. And what happens when that nexus is reached is, well, the end of capitalism. So capitalism will not allow itself to die. It simply will not. It has to maintain itself even if it is lifeless. It has to maintain itself. It's kind of like Dick Cheney. Dick Cheney is lifeless, but he is maintained. There are devices put into his body to keep him alive. If one of those devices were removed, Dick Cheney would die instantly. Capitalism is the same way at this point. The device necessary to keep it alive, not functioning, but keep it alive, is fascism. I mean, the capitalists have stolen so much, and they want more. That's what this election in 2010 is all about. That's why the lies and the deceit continue one upon the other. That's why some piece of human waste like Sharon Angle, or another piece of human waste like Joe Miller, or another one like Palladino, or another one like Christine O'Donnell, or another one like Michelle Bachmann, or another one, just on and on and on, can come into prominence and get elected or reelected. So here we stand, right at the cusp, as capitalism tries to save its own ass and mutate into fascism, which is what it has to do. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Are we going to sit back and let this happen? Well, apparently so.
Fire!
because liberal is a good word. It's more Mike Malloy.
Past the hour, a little more. We talked about Joe Miller in Alaska, who is truly represents the face of, just flat out blatant fascist attitude where it concerns the political system. Joe Miller, he really doesn't have any acquisition of wealth to speak of. He's not a capitalist. He is the next step, the next evolutionary step that capitalism has to go through. It has to mutate, and it is mutation. Well, all evolution is mutation, but it has to mutate into fascism. Has to. So the face of this mutation is Joe Miller. Crooks and Liars talks about the thugs that the army people, the thugs that Joe Miller used to rough up reporters. They aren't just your ordinary street corner hooligans. Glenn Greenwald noted yesterday, we shared it with you last night, that they're also active duty soldiers. On top of that, the company that employs these thugs is called Drop Zone. It's an unlicensed business. And the supplier for the Alaska Militia. Now, by Alaska Militia, I'm not talking about the Alaska National Guard. The website Palin Gates has the details. Here they are. Quote, Drop Zone Security Service is not just a company run by people who are not very clever. But the company is also right at the heart of the Alaska Citizens Militia, a group commanded by one Norm Olson. Remember him? He once rose to fame, quote, as the founder of the Michigan Militia. Drop Zone Bill is the nickname of none other than William Fulton, the owner of Drop Zone Security Services, who came across as a goon during the so-called arrest of Tony Hoffinger the other day, the journalist. Drop Zone Bill uses this nickname for his postings on the Google message board of the Alaska Citizens Militia, which conveniently is public for everyone to see. From the postings, several facts can be established. Mr. Fulton's Drop Zone military surplus shop in Anchorage, which he owns together with his currently unlicensed security company, is a regular meeting point for the members of the militia and appears also to be their main supplier, according to the messages on the website. In addition, Fulton, also known as Drop Zone Bill, is the local commander of the militia. End quote, Palin Gates website. Now, the fact, wouldn't you guess at the fact that Drop Zone Bill employs active duty military people? Wouldn't that be an indication that if the prosecutors in Alaska start peeling that onion, they're going to find that there are members of the military in Alaska who are providing Drop Zone Bill with all sorts of military hardware illegally so that Drop Zone Bill can supply, for a price, of course, the Alaska Militia. Alaska Militia, Jesus Christ. I mean, this is madness. Listen to what I'm talking about. According to Tony Hoffinger's site, he's the journalist who was manhandled by these brown shirts, the Alaska Department of Public Safety is now investigating. And the more you look at Drop Zone, the uglier they get. For instance, check out this Lone Wolf Resistance newsletter. It's from the militia site Patriot Resistance, which is based in Arizona and built out of its page dedicated to the Lone Wolf Survival Manual. Ah! You all remember Lone Wolves, don't you? Does the name James von Brunn, ring a bell? Here is a quote from David Neuwirth writing at Crooks and Liars. The quote, lone wolf, end quote, concept was popularized in the late 1980s by an Aryan Nations leader named Louis Beam as an extension of his strategy of leaderless resistance. One white supremacist, a fellow named Alex Curtis, even went so far as to develop a point system for lone wolves. A 2003 piece by Jessica Stern in Foreign Affairs described how even Al-Qaeda was finding the concept useful. And she explains the origins of Lone Wolf, which I'll share with you when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Prisoner of the fort, the light, he says, at the end of the tunnel was nothing but a burglar's hole. And them that was caught in a cup are all rich and free, but they chained my mind to an endless tomb, and they took my only son from me.
Renegade Talk Radio done right. From the left, it's Mike Malloy.
It's coming through a hole in the air, from those nads to Tiananmen Square. It's coming from
25 before the hour.
This ain't exactly.
All right, I'm coming to your calls here in a minute. First, I'm going to get this email from Kay Petrini. She writes, Mike, on Tuesday's show, you spent quite a bit of time talking about the march this country is taking toward fascism. I spent Tuesday at a seminar sponsored by the Bill of Rights Institute. We were treated to practical strategies for our classrooms and also three outstanding lectures on our founding documents, Common Sense, the Declaration, and the Constitution, held by a professor from one of our local universities. Throughout the day, I couldn't help but draw parallels between then and now, and my hope was to go home and write them up into a report card. But you know what? My intellectual energy is at an all-time low these days, probably from trying to keep up with a six-month-old puppy. Let me digress. No, Kay, it's not from the puppy. I know exactly what you feel. Back to Kay's email. So any kind of profound observations will have to wait until this weekend after I get some sleep. Let me digress again. Kay, that doesn't work. You can get all the sleep you want. As long as you think about what is happening to our country, you're going to stay in the state of fatigue. Anyway, she goes on. In the meantime, I wanted to share something a bit more mundane, but still relevant to the subject of this country's movement toward fascism. Last weekend, several friends and I ran the Nike Women's Marathon here in the city being San Francisco. Okay, so they ran the marathon, I ran the half marathon. The entry fee for this race is on the pricey side, so my friends were upset that Nike cut some serious corners at the finish line. The next day, John Bingham, a columnist for Runner's World magazine, echoed my friend's sentiments when he published a critical review of the race. This is part of what he wrote, How Not to Run a Race. Congratulations to everyone who completed the 2010 Nike Women's Marathon and Half Marathon this weekend. It was, in many ways, a very difficult day, and anyone who crossed the finish line deserves a lot of credit, which is why what happened at the end of the race is so upsetting. I do want to go off on a rant, but I can't keep silent. What I witnessed on Sunday was the single most cruel, heartless, and outrageous display of, well, I don't even know what to call it, inappropriate behavior by a race organizer that I've ever seen. With 20 minutes to go before the published close of the event, a time that the announcer was counting down, some cowboy-hatted jerk decided that the race was over. He turned off the sound, stopped the clock, and literally tore the banners off the finish line structure. Worse, those who finished after the premature closure were denied the finisher's necklace. Shame on anyone and everyone who allowed that to happen. Shame on Nike. Shame on the finish line operations crew. And shame on the cowboy hat clown for being such a jerk. End quote. Kay continues, well, guess what happened? Within a few hours of Bingham publishing his column, it was removed from the website. I was able to find a cached version of it. Who do you think had the power to silence a critic of a race run by such a well-known sponsor? Nike. Could it have been Nike itself? Whether it was indeed Nike or another of the race's corporate co-sponsors, one thing is certain. Corporations do not like it when pipsqueak journalists call them out. And if the pipsqueak is a sports journalist, well, he's that much easier to shut down. All Nike has to do is threaten to pull its ubiquitous ads from his magazine. I realize that this is a relatively minor incident involving the sporting arena, but to me, it is a glaring example of how corporatism has slowly become the law of the land. I started noticing it back when our beloved Candlestick Park, home of the 49ers, was dubbed 3Com Park after the naming rights had been sold. Our baseball park has been through several name changes from Pac Bell to SBC to AT&T. Did I mention Go Giants? Soon, this same corporate naming phenomenon started to show up in road races. The famous San Francisco Beta Breakers became the ING Beta Breakers. Same with the Chicago Marathon. And the last time I tried to look up the showtime for a movie at the Empire Theater, I couldn't find any listings. I knew that the theater was still there because I frequently walked past it, so why couldn't I find it? Because it is now listed under the name of its corporate owner, CineArts at the Empire. Sadly, this is the case with almost every movie theater in my area now. Corporate identity has become paramount in this country over the past three decades. When I show my students the attached photo each year, they are immediately able to identify the corporation represented by each logo. Whether they can identify the Vice President of the United States is another matter entirely. In both significant and mundane ways, the march toward corporatism continues to eat away at the fabric of American society. And when we look at the past 30 years collectively, it's clear that the Citizens United ruling simply put the icing on our fascist cake. Kay. You can read her stuff at kaysreportcard.com. K-A-Y-S. Kaysreportcard.com. Sanchez is in East L.A. listening online. Hey, Sanchez.
Well, regarding Kay's email right now about Joe Biden, perhaps if he put the Nike logo on his forehead, perhaps her students would then be able to
well, they could get the logo right.
Yeah. Well, I think they will remember the person. It's by association, so, yeah, I think they would remember that. It is so tough following Stephen from Burbank, so after this phone call, I'm going to have a shot of Patron Reposado in his honor.
Okay, you could do that. Go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to mention something about Martha Mitchell since you were bringing her up.
You can do anything you want.
Well, thank you. I was hearing a story, and I don't know if you know or can verify this, but the night before John Mitchell had her committed to the, whether it was a loony bin or it was an alcoholic center, she supposedly overheard some sort of a plot about bombing the Twin Towers that John Mitchell was discussing with a few of his guests.
Oh, really? Where did you hear that? I never heard that one.
It was supposedly, I attend all of these different types of lectures and meetings, and this was in a videotape of a program that was aired sometime in the late 1980s. I don't know the name of the program, but if you like, I'll do some research on
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you got too many I don't remembers in there, or I'm not sure where is in there. I wouldn't be surprised, Sanchez, I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Martha Mitchell tried to warn the whole country as to what was going on inside that nest of perversion called the Nixon White House.
Mm-hmm.
She tried to warn anybody who would listen and everybody, and all she got was mocked and laughed at because of her alcoholism,
mm-hmm.
and because of the way she did. Nobody wanted to believe That was the problem. It didn't make any difference if Martha Mitchell was drunk or sober. Nobody wanted to believe what she was saying. It was
right.
It was too over the top. Like, no. They're not doing that, Martha. Now go back to sleep. Go have another drink or whatever. So.
Supposedly after that happened, that weekend that she was committed on, by that Monday morning, she was dead. So that's what this person was saying. But I'll send you the information in an email. I'll do the research here. I'll even check with the person that was showing that particular video to get the exact information for you.
Okay.
Regarding don't ask, don't tell, this is like another accident that I was seeing waiting to happen, you know, the car crashing in front of the brick wall yesterday. And my spidey senses were really up about this. I mean, I could see these poor people getting screwed on this particular incident. For one day, of course, you know that gays were allowed to openly declare, you know, their
right.
sexual preference and still be allowed to enlist in the military or continue to be actively serving in the military. And I'd like to use the incident of Lieutenant Daniel Choi. I'm sure you're
right.
familiar with him.
Yes,
right?
Yeah, he tried
well,
to...
yesterday, he famously was applying at the Armed Service or the Recruitment Center in Times Square.
Mm-hmm.
And all the while that I'm listening to the audio of this on NPR, I'm telling him, no, you're going to get screwed, man. Don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So this morning when I saw him on CNN, he was visibly upset, and of course, understandably upset. And his comments to were in reply to White House advisor Valerie Jarrett's comments. But he was basically saying that the Obama administration is just playing politics before a midterm election, and that he has lost any trust in the Obama administration, and went on to say that basically he will never, ever, ever vote for President Obama again. I honestly, Mike, I have mixed feelings about this. I mean, it was told to a lot of people that this was temporary. I mean, it was very iffy that this was going to hold.
Mm-hmm.
And now I really, really feel sorry for all of these people that have declared openly that they're gay, because now they're in limbo. What
mm-hmm.
happens to these people? I've heard several people today talking about, oh, the law and the procedures and everything else, but so far, to this point, they haven't said a word about what's going to happen to all of these people that have just been recruited or have just announced openly they're gay.
Mm-hmm. So, well, you're right about Sanchez. You're right about or Choi, Lieutenant Choi is right, I think, about the politics of this as it's manifested by the Obama administration. This could have been ended a long time ago, but Barack Obama has shown himself to be unable to do the things I think that a president is required to do. Sanchez, thanks for checking in. I'll talk to you later. We'll be right back. For the hour. I don't know what it takes to really, truly, finally put this country on notice as to how close we are to losing the experiment of self-governance. A lot of people say, well, that's fine, Mike. You know, it's okay. It's time we lost it because we've mistreated it. And, you know, an argument can be made to validate that that theory. But have we misused it? There was an honest attempt, I think, by the framers to keep corporatism, capitalism, separate from the way we govern ourselves. And any time capitalism has snuck into our system of self-government, the result has been horrifying. Destruction. Endless destruction. And the way capitalism has wormed its way into the way we govern ourselves is through the sponsoring or supporting of candidates who would then become senators or representatives or even in the executive branch, president, vice president, cabinet members, and whose sole function, purpose, raison d'etre, was to get into office, to ignore the people, ignore the citizens of the country, and do exactly the bidding of the capitalists, the corporatists, the ones who have no interest whatsoever in the rule of law, no interest whatsoever in justice. It is not their nature. It is impossible, impossible for capitalism and the rule of law to coexist. It cannot be done because capitalism recognizes no law unless that law is made by capitalism. But I feel like a moron sitting here saying this because most of you understand this, right? And if you don't get it, if you don't get it by now, you never will. Jefferson, Lincoln, Eisenhower, they all warned against this. Against the power of corporations, the power, what they were trying to say was the power of capitalism. Jefferson wasn't a capitalist. The people who put this country together, they weren't capitalists. There was no such thing. There were the small businesses, family farms, yeoman kind of stuff, right? But they could see it on the horizon. They could see the corporations, whatever they were, back in the mid-18th century, it was recognized as a force that would destroy representative government, that would destroy a democratic republic as easy as snapping a twig. You know, we can sit here and entertain ourselves forever about how did this happen? We can go back 20 years, 30. Go back to Reagan. Go back to the Bush family. The Bush family that has been on the side of our enemies, our major enemies, for God knows. The Bush family helped the Nazis. The Bush family helped the Chinese communists. The Bush family helped the Saudis. I mean, Jesus God, if there's a family in this country, and there are several. The Fords. The Bushes. The DuPonts. On and on and on. The capitalists, the industrialists who got together to try to figure out a way to assassinate Franklin Roosevelt, who did succeed in assassinating John Kennedy, who have been driving themselves crazy trying to figure out a way to assassinate Barack Obama. How did we get here? Because you and I and the vast majority of the American people never took it seriously. We were led to believe this is all wild-eyed conspiracy theories. That's all it is. Conspiracy. Oh, for Christ's sake. You're going to put your tinfoil hat on, right? Conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory. Conspiracy theory. That and the fact that somehow, some way, we just all went to sleep.
Oh, I'm not going to vote. All those goddamn politicians are the same. I don't care. I'm just going to work, man. I don't care. I got a car payment to make, and, you know, I don't care. It's not a dime's worth of difference between any of them.
Yes, there was at one time. There was a great deal of difference between candidates, among candidates. You know, the framers warned us about political parties, too, right? Watch out. Watch out for the corporatists, i.e. capitalists. Watch out for political parties. Watch out for this collection of power. It is antithetical to people governing themselves. And now we have the teabag fruitcakes, these crazy sons of bitches who are nothing more than the advance guard, the forward wave of fascist America. Well, you didn't think it would happen in your lifetime, did you? We still probably have a little bit of daylight left before the lights go out. Isn't that what they said back when Hitler was making his run for power? The lights are going out across Europe. There might still be a little time left. I'll see you Monday. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Have a great weekend, Kevin, Kenny, wherever you are.